Maybe you joined all those people shopping over the Thanksgiving weekend, and maybe you have some shiny new stuff to show for your efforts. What do you look for when you shop? A good price? Does the price reflect the true cost of the product? In other words, does the price include externalities, the other costs, like the land logged or mined or otherwise disturbed, to be put back in its original state after extraction for your new possession? We'll get deep into the externalities in this hour as we visit with the authors of A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, subtitled A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. It is the work of Raj Patel and Jason Moore. Raj Patel is a research professor at the School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. He's written two previous books about the food system and the reshaping of markets and democracy. Dr. Patel, thanks for joining us.
Jeff, it's a pleasure.
Jason Moore is with us as well. He teaches world history and ecology at Binghamton University. He, too, has written several books, including one about how capitalism affects life on the planet. Jason Moore, welcome
Thank
to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Jeff. It's a pleasure.
So let's get openers from each of you. Let's start with you, Jason. How does this book build on your previous works?
I think this book makes a simple and straightforward argument from the standpoint of the history of the modern world, from Columbus to the present, which is this: cheap is never a bargain. Cheap is about violence. It is about the disrespect and degradation, not just of human life, but of life on this planet, from the original exterminations of Native Americans all the way up to the present moment, which we know in an era of runaway climate change is a history of intergenerational mass murder to come. So those are very, very heavy themes, but we have to come to grips with our times, and we have to begin to see capitalism not as efficient, but as the most inefficient system ever devised to deal with the question of life. Capitalism is not only never cheap, never efficient, it is the most expensive system ever devised to deal with life on this planet.
And Raj Patel, is this a theme that had emerged in your previous works and is just more refined in this book?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we managed to do together is historicize things. Like in an earlier book, in The Value of Nothing, for example, I pointed out that if you were to pay the full environmental cost of eating a dollar burger, if you were to pay for the destruction of rainforests and the pollution of the atmosphere and a range of other things, then the dollar value that some environmental economists put on that would be nearer $200. So $200 is the hidden sort of the hidden cost of a dollar burger. But what we're doing in this book is more subtle. It's not just about externalities, as you pointed out in the introduction, Jeff. What we're doing is showing that actually the history of the past 600 years has been what happens when externalities strike back, when workers can't be squeezed anymore, when the environment is so when human's activities in the web of life is so extreme that there's no more to be burned, no more to be extracted. What happens next? And cheapness for us, as you say, is not a bargain. It's a strategy that has hollowed out our relationships with the web of life, and which we're coming to reckon with right now.
So cheap, not a bargain, not a compliment on effective pricing here. The seven categories are cheap nature, cheap money, cheap work, cheap care, cheap food, cheap energy, and ultimately cheap lives. Jason Moore, at least one listener, I'm sure, will label you lefty, anti-capitalist academics. How would you characterize yourself?
Well, I would characterize myself as somebody who has tremendous hope for our future, and that if we look at what has happened over the past five centuries, the history of capitalism, it's a history of unremitting and extraordinary violence, both in the sense of killing, but also in the sense of laying waste to human possibility, I think. And at the same time as capitalism shows us what could be, it denies those possibilities. It denies us the possibilities of a livable planet. It denies us the possibility of fulfilling work. Just ask somebody in one of Amazon's packing warehouses or at Foxconn's plants in China. It denies us the possibility of treating our families and children with care and dignity and real value. So we point out that the value of capitalism is, in a sense, the value of nothing, as Raj has reminded us, but the value of something that is extremely narrow. And capitalism basically says we are only going to count dollar signs, and we are going to convince all the rest of you, humans, but also the rest of nature, to work for free or for very, very low cost.
So you say capitalism shows us what could be. Take that a little further. What could be?
Well, what could be would be a system in which there is a social priority on the things that are cheapened under capitalism, a social priority on care, not just care for ourselves, for the young and old, but care for planetary life. It shows us the possibility of real democracy, but systematically denies that. It shows us that there are other ways of organizing a community and life that would be profoundly liberatory.
Raj, there's a statement here that it's that polls show it's easier for most people to imagine the end of the planet than the end of capitalism. Is that true?
Well, I mean, it's certainly, I mean, every time we give a talk, it's much, I mean, we ask people this question. And it's certainly the case that it's hard for people to imagine what life would be like after capitalism. You mentioned earlier on, Jeff, that we might be labeled sort of cranky academics and sort of wild-eyed lefties. Though I have to say, when I was at Berkeley and I mentioned the word capitalism, people looked at me like I'd farted in a lift. I mean, you know, just to be able to say capitalism is already to have mentioned something awkward and a topic around which people are squeamish. And if we love capitalism so much, that then just saying the word on the radio oughtn't to drive people into a frenzy of, oh, these are lefty academics. Much more than that, I think what this world, as Jason was saying, sort of promises and yet denies, is the idea that we're living in the best of all possible worlds. And in fact, we live, capitalism makes the best of all possible worlds almost impossible.
Wow. We will explore that statement a bunch further. The book is called A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. Raj Patel and Jason Moore, the authors, are guests on The Exchange. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk more with them and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us. Back on The Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guests today are a couple of professors from a couple of different universities, Raj Patel at the University of Texas, Jason Moore at Binghamton University. They are the co-authors of a book called A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. And it's about the ways in which there are costs beyond just what we pay for products, costs on people, costs on the planet. And in fact, the categories they give are cheap nature, cheap money, cheap work, cheap care, cheap food, cheap energy, and ultimately cheap lives. You can join a conversation, the conversation on The Exchange, at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Jason Moore, then, is capitalism more of a problem than just the way humans naturally live? I ask this because some of the things that our species has done, like overhunting, predates market systems, right?
Right. Well, if you look at the late Pleistocene extinctions in North America, where hunter-gatherers do seem to be involved in the extinction of the truly big megafauna of that era, that occurred over thousands of years. It was also wrapped up with climate change, which was ultimately much more decisive in those distinctions. And it's important to understand that for all civilizations existing before capitalism, before Columbus really launches the invasion of the New World in 1492, for all civilizations, environmental change moved in centuries. It moved in millennia. In capitalism, everything moves faster by an order of magnitude. So forests get laid waste in decades or years, not centuries. That's a fundamentally different dynamic. And indeed, what capitalism does is it really invents the idea and the practice of nature, of, oh, there's nature out there. It's the forests and the fields and the birds and the bees and the streams. And yes, that is part of nature, but humans evolved on this planet too. And what humans do is part of that process as well. Now, that doesn't make it all hunky-dory. It's human history is full of all sorts of violence and inequality. our point, I think, is that capitalism is not an economic system, although it involves economics. It is a way of organizing the relations between humans and the rest of nature. And one of the fundamental points in the book is that our environmentalist sacred idea of nature with the big, pretty old-growth forests and the charismatic tigers, yeah, that's part of it. But in fact, the idea of nature has been linked to a long practice of racist and sexist and colonial practice where most human beings, in fact, were not part of society. They were relocated into the realm of nature as part of this violent and unequal history of the modern world, which is a capitalist world.
Relocated into nature, how? You mean like thrust off onto reservations?
Thrust off into reservations is a perfect example. You see it today with mass incarceration, that peoples of color overwhelmingly incarcerated in today's prisons are exiled from society. They are not part of society. They are deprived of their civil rights. They are deprived of their political rights. That has a very long history that goes back to Columbus around indigenous peoples. Yes, they would be treated as not human, not quite human. You saw it in colonial practices with the English in Ireland. You saw it with women in the 16th and 17th centuries, where all of a sudden there was a radical and stark divide between the public and the private, between man and woman. And that was something that had not been seen before. There was inequality before, but not in these stark ways. So a lot of what we talk about is this either-or way that the modern world works, nature versus society, black and white, the West and the rest, those kinds of divides. And we point out that that is a history of profound violence and profound inequality that is ultimately rooted in this very old, very powerful idea that's governed a lot of our lives in the modern world, which is that society is one thing, that's humans without nature, and nature is out there somewhere. But in practice, that has shaped exactly what you just mentioned, putting Indians onto reservations, reorganizing colonial populations into what was called during the Vietnam War strategic hamlets. That, in fact, goes all the way back to Ireland and to the Andes in the 16th century. And so this is a really important part of our book, that the idea of nature is somehow out there is really a problem to our politics and to our politics of dealing with climate change.
The book is called A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. Authors Jason Moore and Raj Patel are our guests on the Jefferson Exchange. Raj, you mentioned the $1 burger that actually should cost about $200. In the book, Chicken McNuggets is given as the poster child for our time. How does that hit all seven cheap things?
Well, briefly, Jeff, I mean, the reason we use Chicken McNuggets is just as a story of saying, look, you may have heard of the Anthropocene, you know, the way of talking about the era in which we find ourselves, because there will be, you know, radioactivity from nuclear tests and, you know, evidence of the Great Extinction. But actually, the trillions and trillions of chicken bones that are left in the soil are a sign that we shouldn't call this era the Anthropocene. We should call it the Capitalocene, because there's nothing innate to humans that generates trillions of chicken bones. You know, right now, there are, 12 billion chickens alive, but not for long, because we go through 50 billion of them a year. But in order to have that chicken, you need to be able to have cheap nature. You pluck that chicken from the jungles for free. You genetically modify it so that it can't walk. Get workers to be paid bottom dollar in order to be able to turn it into a McNugget. Those workers are horribly abused. If they're paid at all, they're paid very badly. They suffer high rates of occupational injury, so they need to be taken care of once they're discarded from the production. So you need cheap care as well as cheap work. You need cheap food to feed those workers as well as the chickens. You need cheap money to be able to fund this entire cycle. You know, every KFC is a small business and given access to cheap, low-interest loans. You need cheap energy to distribute and to fuel the machines and the processes that give this cheap chicken. And you need cheap lives. You need a cadre of people who, as Jason was saying, are sort of cast aside from society. And so that's why in the making of your McNuggets, you have workers who are disproportionately women and people of color who are whose lives are valued at somewhat less than you know, white people in American society.
So, Raj, the idea of counting more than just the balance sheet, I mean, the effects on many people and systems, have civilizations historically done that? Have any done that?
Well, I mean, I don't think that there are civilizations that go around with a calculator saying, well, you know, if we measure this and we quantify it, then we should probably stop ourselves from doing this, that, or the other. But what we do have is histories and, in fact, contemporary civilizations that do things like collective management of resources. So in an article in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences a few years ago, what researchers looked at societies of indigenous people in forests, and they found that if indigenous people in forests have enough land to be able to recover from a disaster, then those people will, through the ways that their civilization manages the forest, they will stint. They will, in other words, they will not chop down every tree that's available. They will hold back from chopping down the trees. They will manage the resources in ways that are respectful of their position in the web of life, in their relationship to these other things. And you may think, well, these are forest people who are doing much worse off than everyone else. But in fact, researchers found that their management of the forest led to much faster and much more robust development in terms of community welfare than if the government came in or if a corporation came in. So compared to the public and the private, there is an alternative. And there are civilizations today that are showing us how to do it. So one doesn't need to fantasize some specious past. One can look to the human civilizations that aren't destroying the planet right now to get a clue about what it would be like for us not to be in a relationship with nature that treated it as entirely disposable.
But now, Jason Moore, in the past, have people in more nature-friendly societies been considered savages because of their religion or because of their reverence for nature?
Well, so we talk about this in the book, that the word savage goes from having a fairly positive meaning in the 13th century to becoming a word that is tightly associated with colonial populations. And indeed, the language of nature and society and civility and savagery, these all begin to assume their modern day meanings in the English language in the 16th century. And that was an era in which England was tightening and deepening its control over Ireland, which was not part of Europe. And the Celtic peoples in general, and the Irish in particular, were absolutely beyond the pale. Of course, that's an expression that comes from a line drawn around the outskirts of Dublin, and that beyond the pale were the savage people. These human beings were not part of society. They were part of nature. And here's the thing when we talk about this question of externality, it's not just about the costs that are externalized. Human beings and other forms of life are put into this category, into this governing idea called nature, in order to make those human beings and other creatures work harder and harder and harder under more and more violent conditions. So we can trace this all the way from the English in Ireland, the Spanish in the New World, to mass incarceration today, where you have 2 million workers who are essentially working for free for big business. And this is an example of how externalization isn't just about dumping your pollution. Treating nature as external to society is also a powerful way of racializing and gendering cheap work.
We are talking to Raj Patel and Jason Moore about their book, A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. Cheap things again, nature, money, work, care, food, energy, and lives. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760. Is there a better way besides capitalism? 800-838-3760. Emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. And I'm going to take some calls. Jason, you'll hear some popping and clicking as I put you on hold and take you back out. Here's Mara Lee in Ashland. Welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you. This is a very, very, sometimes a scary topic, mm-hmm. because I've been living a life over the last almost 30 years. First of all, I'm going to speak about it from the point of view of the fact that I took an oath of voluntary simplicity. I also lived in a fairly wealthy community in California growing up, and I saw things at a very early age. I've actually wanted to write a book about it, and I don't know where to start. But it's as if by the time you live well, you already have been when you choose to live well, you start to feel like you're being tossed out of society, like you are no longer a commodity. I feel good about the way I live. I live in my car. I live on the streets of Ashland. Nobody will really take me in to put my car on their property because they see me as a person that probably has a mental health problem, I guess. But I say to the point where I don't even like to buy a battery. Like, I'm using the phone. I'm using the transistor radio, which I've had for years. People kind of ignore me on the streets. They don't give eye contact. I'm 70. I live on Social Security. I have nothing to give them. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I feel happy that I'm withdrawing and withdrawing every day. I don't want anything to do with the holidays. I don't feel anybody wants me around. I don't look good enough. I don't buy enough things. I don't have a phone, you know, one of these phones. But I sometimes feel like in my death comes my celebration for the fact that I've lived well, and I'm not a capitalist.
All right, living well, but in a way that other people would define it very differently. Marilee, thanks for that. I want to get a response from Raj.
Well, Marilee, thank you for your call, thank you for pointing out that actually to reject the trappings of the way that we are made to live today is already to expose oneself to ridicule. But I think to be living already in a way that is contrary to the way that we're being taught is seditious. But I think that to imagine that the kind of society and the kind of civilization we find ourselves in is a sane one when we have all the evidence showing us that it is causing extinction, that it is destroying the ecosystem on which we all depend, that seems to me to be a sign of very grave mental condition. That we imagine that the capitalism is doing just fine, except for the fact that it's destroying the planet. But other than that, ignore all the big stuff. But look, we've got a new iPhone. That seems to me to be precisely the kind of social sort of transformation that's necessary for us to contort ourselves into so that we can survive the madness of this society. But I also wanted to say that I think if we're imagining a transformation, the kind of transformation after capitalism doesn't have to be, and in a sense it can't be, individual. And neither Jason nor I are particularly, although we see the possibilities, we also see the dangers. We're not, to return to your point earlier on, Jeff, academics are like, oh, capitalism is ending, hooray! We're not thrilled with capitalism, but we're also historians enough to understand that what might come after may be far worse. And we have to make choices now. We have to prepare ourselves now so that the kinds of world that we live in afterwards are better. But to do that, we have to do it collectively. It's important to take individual steps. Of course it is. But the kinds of transformation that we imagine happen next are not ones that are individual acts of resistance, but they are collective ones too.
All right, yeah, so not just a single person dropping out of the economic system, but a bunch, or just changing things altogether. Let's take another call. Here's Anne and Eugene. Welcome to The Exchange with Raj Patel and Jason Moore.
Thank you. I can't wait to read your book. I'm so glad to know about it. So capitalism depends on growth, and you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. And we're already hugely overpopulated with human beings, and many of those human beings are living miserably. And then you have capitalism having this huge propaganda machine that is working all over the world to get people to buy more, use more, throw away more. So my thing is, while I don't live nearly as simply as your prior caller, I have went from involuntary simplicity in my earlier years to voluntary simplicity, like being a bicycle a commuter and stuff like this.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm very glad that I'm 75 years old and have no children or grandchildren, because I think the human species is going to go down the drain in a big way.
Yikes.
So thank you.
Thanks for that, Anne. Appreciate that. Jason, your thoughts on what Anne was just saying?
Well, I think In one way, yes, I share your concern. In another, I think that the easiest position is to say, well, we're all going to kill each other. We're all going to kill ourselves, and human beings aren't going to be around on the planet. Well, human beings are distinguished by a remarkable creativity and a remarkable capacity for social memory and social cooperation. So when we talk about things like simplicity, I think that a socialist vision, for instance, would emphasize things like bike lanes. Now, if you live in Eugene, Oregon, where it has more bike lanes per capita than any place in the world, except for maybe Copenhagen, then it's different. But if you look at those two examples, those are bike lanes and public transportation systems in places like Copenhagen that are organized by the state. And so we have to remember, after 40 years of horizontalism and of, well, let's all protest in the streets, we need to come back to a vision for political power that is going to be central to revaluing life and to reestablishing collective consumption, that is bike lanes, free public transportation, agriculture that is organized around towns and cities that won't just spring up autonomously. It requires infrastructure of all kinds, information infrastructure, transport infrastructure, distribution infrastructure. So we have to think seriously about the politics of our moment.
Okay, Jason, and hold the thought, because we need to come back and finish this up. A History of the World in 7 Cheap Things with Raj Patel and Jason Moore. Back in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about the system of capitalism that pretty much rules the world and its effect on nature. It has a very profound impact, as our guests have been saying. They are Raj Patel from the University of Texas and Jason Moore from Binghamton University. They're the co-authors of a book called A History of the World in 7 Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. The cheap things listed are nature, money, work, care, food, energy, and lives. You can join the conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Jason, you were just talking about the things that we need to do together to move beyond the things that we do for ourselves as individuals. And you were just starting to talk about the politics of the moment, which raises the question, how in a society where even the whiff of socialism can still get you labeled as, I don't know, some kind of pinko, that's a term from about 60 years ago, but how do you begin to advance an agenda that involves some sense of, here we go again with another dangerous term, collectivization?
Well, let's be clear about one thing, that we already live under a system of socialism that is basically this, socialism for the rich. So the last thing that big business ever wants is for the state to get out of doling out public money to make its profits higher. So we need to be aware that that already exists, and that much of what of the cities, of the infrastructure in this country, in fact, much of the American economy, 37% of the American economy already comes from government spending at all levels. So let's be clear that we are living in a country that is socialism for the 1%. And what we need is a way to deal with the enormity of climate change coming. And I don't think anyone's really ready for this. I don't think that folks have really wrapped their minds around it. Even when radicals and liberals and progressives talk about climate change, I don't think that they really get it. I think that this is, well, it's what Earth system scientists call a state shift. And the words that they use are very uncharacteristic for scientists. They talk about abrupt, irreversible, dramatic changes to the conditions of life on this planet. And what we're talking about in this book is that we need a political state shift. And so the question about, oh, socialism, we can't have that. Well, in fact, if you look at the polling data for under 30, socialism has a remarkably favorable rating. Now, if you also go to some place like Puerto Rico, you can see the difference between Cuba and Puerto Rico. Cuba has lots of problems, and I'm not saying we should all live like Cuba. But if you live in the United States, you are 15 times more likely to die from a hurricane than if you live in Cuba. And guess what? Those hurricanes are going to keep coming, one on top of the other.
Raj Patel, there's a whole section of the book that gives us to a very good historic example of the ways in which all of the chiefs sort of lined up. Why is the island of Madeira in here so much?
Madeira is sort of exhibit A for us in terms of a part of the world where one of the big, the first big capitalist commodity, sort of agricultural crop came from, which is sugar. And so Madeira is there because, again, you see the seven cheap things at work. But in telling the story of Madeira, we come across a character who appears throughout the book, Christopher Columbus. Who was one of the sailors, who one of the captains who plied money and wool and sugar to and from Europe to Madeira. And the reason that that Madeira crops up, and the reason that Christopher Columbus crops up, is because if you think about capitalism as historic, if you think of the sort of origins of capitalism, then Christopher Columbus is both a particularly vile exponent of it, but someone who is alive and well today. Look, I mean, who else do we know who is in the middle of, who's made vast amounts of money by promising bankers on the back of very little sort of poor past performance to lend him money so that he can colonize a whole new area and bring back vast returns? Well, if you want a modern day Columbus who's, plying their trade, think of Jeff Bezos or think of Elon Musk. Now, these are our heroes at the moment, and Jeff Bezos apparently now is worth $100 billion. But look at what they're doing. They're arguing for colonizing the moon and Mars. They're all in the process of exploiting. Both of them have cases open against their firms from the National Labor Relations Board. They themselves may not be necessarily directly involved in slavery, but their products certainly depend on the kinds of modern day slavery that exist in, say for example, the Democratic Republic of Congo. All of these seven cheap things, which we trace from Madeira and characters like Christopher Columbus, are with us today. And again, the argument that we're making in the book is that they're not with us for much longer.
So let's talk about the alternative, world ecology. There's a hyphen between the words. What is that?
So world ecology is basically a recognition that the master ideas of the modern world, which are nature and society, or nature versus humanity, are in fact deeply implicated in the kinds of environmental devastations, in the kinds of racial and gendered inequalities that we have seen across the modern world. So world ecology says we need a new conversation around knowledge. We need 21st century knowledge for 21st century problems. And right now what we have are a lot of Earth system scientists producing very valuable insights about what's happening to the planet, but they don't get what's happening to capitalism's ecology, because capitalism has its own ecology within the web of life. And then you have human and social scientists who get the history, get the questions of domination and of difference and of race and gender and class and all that, but don't really get the questions of the Earth system. And what we need are new forms of knowledge that put these two questions together, the questions of the Earth and the questions of human beings working together on and in that Earth. And that is going to produce, I think, very different kinds of knowledges and very different kinds of politics in the century ahead.
Jason Moore and Raj Patel are the co-authors of A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, A Guide to Capitalism, Nature, and the Future of the Planet. Here's a call from Gail and Eugene. Welcome to The Exchange.
Yes, hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Yes, you've sort of gone a little past the subject, but the 18th point in the in the Declaration of Independence, I'd like to read it to you. It's very short. It's that all the complaints about Henry the King.
George.
The 18th one is George, sorry. Yes, George. This is the 18th one. He has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. I just thought that was so interesting to have that in our Declaration of Independence.
That really is. Thanks for bringing that up, Gail. Appreciate that. But this gets into the whole thinking of things in nature as being savage. And Raj, you point out in the book that it wasn't just indigenous people were considered part of nature, but women too, you point out.
Right. I mean, every human civilization has been more or less patriarchal, but none of them have been sexist in the way that capitalism is. And there is a process that we've sort of called the Great Domestication that happens, again, at the sort of beginning of capitalism with the invention of this strange new thing called the household. And with the invention of the household comes a way in which women are removed from society, not from not necessarily from being put on reservations, but thinking of the household as precisely this new thing that, for which we have inventions of terms like the private sector or the private space rather than the public space. So private space becomes an area in which, just as the king lords it over his subjects, husbands are able to lord it over women in the home, women and children. And so that idea of having a sort of natural warrant to be able to do that, that somehow patriarchy is natural in this particular way of men being in charge of women, particularly in this new space of the household, that's something that capitalism has invented, and other civilizations have quite different views about that.
Let's take another call here. I want to go to Tim in Grants Pass. Jim in Grants Pass, welcome to The Exchange.
Yes, good morning. A couple of quick things. Supposedly says something in the Bible about go forth and multiply. I get teenagers together and say, let's do a little multiplying. 2 times 2 is 4, 4 times 4 is 16, 16 times 6. I say, just stop me. When you honestly feel we've reached a number that you can be responsible for. And there's another one. It's all right to kill a ox if it gores 2 people, but it doesn't tell what to do productively with the remains of that ox.
Huh. Interesting. Okay, so overpopulation and too much stuff around. Let me move this conversation beyond where we are now, then, because yes, we do have a planet that's got 7.5 billion people perhaps on it. Capitalism seems to be the ruling force of the day. So where do we go then, Jason Moore, if we're going to do a system that there are lots of failed systems to look at that were done in contravention of capitalism, like the so-called workers' paradise of the Soviet Union? That didn't go over so big.
Well, let's be clear about a few things. While the Soviet experiment was rather dismal in many ways, let's be clear that it was the Soviets who destroyed Nazism. So we can all wake up every day and say thank you to the Soviets for smashing Hitler's regime. And that's worth paying attention to. In China, again, lots and lots of problems, but if you look at life expectancy in China between 1949 and 1979, life expectancy goes up from about 35 to about 67. So that's a big deal, and I think that would be a big deal for many people around the world. If you are born in Cuba, you are going to have a longer life expectancy than the average resident, say, of Washington, D.C., who is, of course, African-American. And you are, if you are a mother giving birth in a place like Cuba, then you are going to live much longer. You are going to survive childbirth at a much greater rate than African-American mothers in this country. So we should be careful not to dismiss these examples. We can also look at what happened after the end of cheap energy in Cuba, where there was no famine, and the average Cuban, it's true, lost about 10 kilograms, 20 pounds or so, but also heart disease collapsed. Heart disease declined radically, and everybody was fed. So those are big deals, especially in a world where we have 3 billion plus people who are malnourished. That's a huge deal. But in terms of look at places like the United States. There are very easy steps that could be taken. One is to make sure there is health care for all. So take health care out of the market. Another is to make sure there is child care for all and take child care out of the market. Take education back into the public sphere after Bush and Obama, and now I'm sure Trump has been radically pushing to privatize education. We need to restore some basic elements of public life and take them out of the market, which has been tremendously wasteful. It's now come out that charter schools are much less effective at teaching students than public schools and things like that. So I think that's a first step. We're not, we don't need to have, the red flag hoisted over the White House. I'm not saying that. I'm saying let's take some fundamental elements of life out of the market, give transportation, healthcare, childcare, to everyone who needs it. And by the way, let's get all these cars off the road.
It is so easily batted down, though, it seems like, in election after election by Republicans who just say, don't you want freedom? And boom, that's the end of the discussion.
Well, of course, because we don't live in a democracy. We live in a republic, which was, as one of the callers mentioned, premised on not just on genocide and the extermination of Indians and slavery and the distinction of public and private spheres that Raj mentioned. Locke, who really formulates this, and we talk about John Locke, was the formative political philosopher of the American Revolution.
Let's finish up then with a question for you, Raj, about how do you get people who have always thought of humans as apart from nature to begin to take nature into account when making decisions?
I think we have plenty of examples and plenty of societies that do that. Whether it's, you know, I mean, and I certainly think that when one looks at First Nations, for example, and thinks about the way that First Nations have treaties with other animals, that's a very different way of thinking about how we might feed one another than by just, you know, rounding animals up and putting them in these concentrated animal feeding operations. But I think, you know, this isn't the sort of thing we get to do individually. There's no sort of going out and hugging a tree and saying, oh, well, I've renegotiated my relationship with nature. It's the sort of thing that can only happen through movements, through social movements. And I think that that's what's very interesting and very promising right now in looking at social movements around the world. They are starting to move towards seven cheap things. So you're understanding seven cheap things. So you have farmers' movements that care about the domestic violence. You have unions that are starting to care about care work. All of this is a sign that if we are parts of movements together, we can dream much bigger than we've been allowed to so far.
Well, a very provocative discussion. Apologies to the two phone calls I didn't take. We're talking to the authors of A History of the World in Seven Cheap Things, Raj Patel and Jason Moore. Thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.